Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this episode, we're talking about plastic pollution in the Great Lakes and beyond. And up first, we speak with Dr. Loreno Rios-Mendoza, Associate Professor of Chemistry at UW-Superior. Dr. Rios first started her research on microplastics at the University of the Pacific in 2003. She joined UW-Superior in 2010 and began looking more closely at pollution from microbeads in Lake Superior, as well as Lakes Michigan, Huron, and Erie. We spoke to Dr. Rios last week in her office at UWS.
First off, can you tell me a little bit about the research that you've been doing over the last several years related to microplastics and what's going to be happening moving forward?
You know, I'm starting to study the microplastic debris in North Pacific Jar in California in 2003. In 2010, I moved from California to Wisconsin, and I see the Great Lakes, and I say, hey, we have a water here, you know. And then in 2013, we did for first time the, no, 2012. For the first time, we collected samples on the lakes. We went to Lake Superior, Huron, and Lake Erie. And we found in the Lake Erie, we found these microbeads. So tiny sizes, are very rounded and beautiful pellets that we say, this is, what is the source of that? And then that our hypothesis was in that time that could be the cosmetic products. Yeah. And then later searching about it, it's incredible all the compounds that contain microplastic, microbeads. But what is the main problem with this? Is smaller the size can mimic more easily the natural food. And then this means it's so easily ingested by the organism. And this is not just the problem, because just alone the plastic, we can think is so huge a molecule that cannot interact with the cell membrane. But the problem is can absorb toxic compounds. All the hydrophobic compounds that is in the water are absorbed on the surface of the microplastic. And then this is the problem, because now it's a vector, a new source for this toxic compost that can go to the organisms and the small organisms and, you know, the bigger, and we can think in the fish. And at the end, we eat at the fish. And some of these toxic compounds are endocrine disruptors. But finally, we really don't know what is the effect at the end in the human health. This is part of the new research that we are working.
You're going to be studying or have been studying water treatment plants or water near treatment plants to find out how much of this microplastic debris is found in those areas and the level of toxic compounds they contain, right?
I will start this summer collecting samples outside to the wastewater treatment plant, the water that goes directly to the lake, to see what is the quantification, how much of this we have, and the microplastic, and what is the concentration of the toxic compounds. That I'm working already is with all microplastic, microbeads, or the small fragment from the big items of plastic that is just is suffering just the photodegradation, and then is making smaller and smaller pieces, but it still is plastic. And I'm working with the absorption in the polyaromatic, that is the one type, the compounds that are from incomplete combustion. This means from the gasolines. And the PCBs that were banned already in the 70s in the United States. And some area, like in the power industry, is using in container that is totally closed, but in somehow we have these compounds still in the nature, here in the Great Lakes. And the other is the organochloride pesticides, like DDTs that were banned too in the United States. But, you know, we have the transference for the atmospheric transference, and then we can find it still.
So why are you expanding your research to include these areas near the water treatment plants? I mean, what are you hoping to find as a result of sampling near there?
That I want is to test in the hypothesis of the most of the microbeads from cosmetic products come from the wastewater treatment plant. Because the wastewater treatment plant wasn't created to retain this kind of the particulates. the main objective is to kill bacteria, not really retain plastic. And then I'm sure we are find it. This is the main source for the microbeads from cosmetic products.
So you're thinking that, you know, if people are flushing their cosmetic items either down the toilet or down the drain when they're washing their face in the morning or doing whatever else, that it's going through the wastewater treatment plants, it's getting flushed out into the lake, and then potentially many organisms or fish are consuming that as food because they think it's food.
Exactly. This is the main problem. A smaller the size is so easily to confuse like a food, natural food. This is why the plastic behave like a mimic food. But the main problem is that if these pieces of plastic stay enough time in the lake, can concentrate more than 1 million times of toxic compounds in the water. They can concentrate in very small area, because smaller the size means higher the surface area to concentrate these toxic compounds. And then if the organisms, like a fish, ingest the this small microbes with the toxic compounds, the next study that we need to do is how long take to the toxic compounds absorb on the surface of the plastic to the tissue in the fish. But and then the next question is, the endocrine system in the fish is damaged and the problem ended there, and we can eat at the fish with no complication, or when we eat at the fish, the problem go with us.
So the concern is whether or not fish are going to be consuming these toxic compounds and then us having eaten them, that we would also be susceptible to the effects of these compounds.
Yes, this is the theory.
Tell me where you're going to be sampling. I understand that you're going to be starting here in Duluth Superior and then also going along the Shawangan Bay.
Yes, I will collect it in the San Luis River, in the wastewater treatment plant in Duluth, in Superior, to Harbors, in Washburn, and Ashland, and Bayfield.
So once you do all the sampling then this summer, like, what are you looking to sample for? Are you just going to be taking water samples and then analyzing that in the winter?
Yes, that we are taking is with trolling with the manta troll, that is called the manta because it's the same like the organisms from the ocean, the manta, right? And then we filter the water for maybe 1 hour. It is possible because it's depending how many organisms we can find in the lake. And then we filter the water during 1 hour, a very slow speed in the boat. And if it is possible to go inside to the wastewater treatment plant, I will take water inside before that they go to the lake to have two different sampling and can compare what's going on.
I guess, are you only sampling the water, or are you going to be testing fish or other organisms for these compounds then?
We just collected water sample inside and outside to the wastewater plant and then river, in San Luis River water. But I will have a fish for DNR or maybe from another institution that can give me the fish, and we open the stomach and we search if we can find plastic.
Okay, so you're planning to work with the DNR, Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, or also the Great Lakes Fish and Wildlife Commission?
Yes, I'm thinking they will give me the fish, and then we can open and see if the fish is really ingested plastic or not. Already I was working with the DNR and with the Great Lakes Fish and Wildlife Commission, and already that we found is just fibers, plastic fibers. We don't find it any fragment of plastic. It's possible from the clothing, from the washing machine, you know, at home, or from the carpets. You know, we have I think it's mainly for the clothes, synthetic clothes.
Okay. So then how long are you planning to analyze this, or when do you expect to have preliminary findings from your research that you'll be doing this summer?
You know, all the summer we start to collecting samples and preparing the samples. And I think for January, maybe we can have some chemical results. For how much that we found and what is that we found, I think at the end to the in December, maybe we can have some preliminary result. But if I want to work with the chemistry, the toxic compounds absorbed on the microplastic will be January, February.
So what do you want people to know about why this research is important as it relates to them?
Already we are one society that we are addicted with the plastic. And the young people, they have the solution, but we need to teach them how to live with the plastic. Because they think, how can I do it? It's plastic everywhere. Yeah, and they don't know how, like you are young person, and then I was living with the transition between the glass to the plastic, and I was resistant to use the plastic, but now I'm used plastic so easily because it's so beautiful
and it doesn't break as easy.
Yes, and it's so cheap. But the main problem is that it is so cheap, it's so easily discarded and disappear. You don't see it and you think it's gone, but it's not. It's in the ocean, it's in the lake. And then can stay here forever and ever, because there is no really organism that can destroy the polymer, the plastic synthetic, the synthetic plastic.
So no matter how long it's out there forever. It does not break down.
Yes, exactly. There is some people that start to study what's going on with some enzymes or some bacteria that can have mutations, and maybe they can start to be able to eat the plastic, but I don't think so. I think that the bacteria are able to eat it, the different chemicals that the plastic industry put it to get the final plastic product.
Is there anything else about your research that you would like people to know?
You know, I think that we need to understand that the plastic is good, but at the same time has the very dark side. And we need to be very responsible to use the plastic, you know, and I know if we asking to pay it for the plastic bag in the grocery stores, I know many people don't use a lot because now it's free and it looks like it's mandatory to use the plastic bags and use just one time. And then later we have this problem, you know, and then I think we need to be very responsible when we use the plastic, and we need to learn to say no, reject the use of the plastic and recycle the most possible, because at the end the only that we are doing is damage the future in our children, you know. And then I think we need to be careful with that.
So trying to find products or buy products that don't have plastic in them, like if they're using face wash or products that are still using those micro beads as part of the cosmetics, to look for something with an alternative.
Exactly. We can come back to the natural, you know. Before they were using just the seed from the fruits. And then we can do it again. Of course, it's a little more expensive to keep it because our organic compound that is so easily degrade. But still, it's something that the nature can recycle. And then it's okay. But now, I know the plastic at the first was really nice, a good solution, but now we know it's not. And then we need to find different alternatives. I went to 2 weeks ago in the one International Joint Commission in Canada, where we have a binational agreement to study the Great Lakes. And then we divided the workshop in the education area, in the policy markets and the research. And I was in the research area, and then we decided that we need to study, you know, what's going on with the plastic. We need to have a harmonization in the different methodologies, different people that is working with the plastic. We need to try to use the same methodology to get it better results, to see what's going on with the big picture of the plastic. Because at the end, that we want to know is what happened with the human health.
Because it affects us too, not just fish, not just the organisms in the water.
Yes, at the end, we are the situation, you know. And then that I'm saying, if this plastic can absorb toxic compounds, and some of them can produce cancer, can be endocrine disruptors, can produce mutagenesis, too many very bad things. And then we need to be careful with that. We need to stop the source. The source of the plastic to the lakes, to the ocean, and we are the source.
Thank you, Dr. Rios. I appreciate you taking time to talk with us.
No, thank you for your interest in plastic pollution.
You've been listening to an interview with Dr. Loreno Rios Mendoza, Associate Professor of Chemistry at UW-Superior, about microplastics pollution. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. When we come back, we'll hear from a Northland College grad who will set out with two friends this week on an ultra run around the lake. Andy Butter joins us to tell us about their run around the lake and how they plan to capture people's stories and samples for microplastics research. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we're talking about plastic pollution in the Great Lakes and beyond. We just heard from Dr. Lorena Rios Mendoza, a UW-Superior professor doing research on microplastics in Lake Superior. Up next, we hear from Northland College grad Andy Butter. Butter and his friends Evan Flum and Alyssa Studi are planning to run around Lake Superior this summer and are set to head out on their journey this Friday. Butter spoke to us about their trip and how they plan to collect samples for microplastics research.
We've been planning it for so long. It's been a year and a half now, so like the exact details, no one's exactly sure. But originally, there was a group of five of us, the original three, me, Evan, and Alyssa, and two other folks that were going to do it. And we wanted to, we were hanging out in Duluth one day, and we all had recently graduated, and like, well, what do we do? You know, we want to do something constructive and also something together, because kind of this feeling of once after you graduate of like, you know, community kind of coming apart. So I think that was in part driving it, and we want to do something kind of big. And someone just threw out the idea of running around the lake, and we, I guess, collectively decided that would be a good thing to do. And then from there, we kind of sat on a couple months, and it was far enough off in the distance that it could easily not happen. You know, someone could get a job and go somewhere else, and you could easily just be like, oh yeah, that was a funny idea. But after a couple months, we were thinking that if we do this, we'll get attention for it, whether we want to or not. You know, like people will be like, hey, what are you doing running around the lake? And so we wanted to kind of like harness and maybe redirect that energy into things that we thought were, you know, more important or should be brought to light more than just us and our personal stories. And so from there, it kind of took on its own momentum and shape as we start thinking about, like, what could we do to do more than just run, you know, like, what issues could we talk about? And that's when we got in contact with the organization called Adventurers and Scientists for Conservation, and jumped on their microplastics freshwater pollution study and adding to their database. And then also got really excited about the idea of storytelling, like interviewing people and sharing that through our website and social media.
Well, and how are you going to be able to do all that, too? Because, I mean, I was reading the article that was in the Ashland Daily Press about this, and you guys are going to have this thing that you're pushing while you're running to carry all of your belongings?
Yeah, so we're having, well, there's a debate if it's called a cargo stroller or, like, a baby stroller, but really it's for, like, a stroller for kids, you know, that you, like, pull behind a bike or something, and it has, like, seats for two kids, but we have an attachment, a jogging wheel attachment, so we'll be pushing it. So that's how we're going to be self-supported, so we don't have a support vehicle. You know, we're going to have all of our stuff on us all the time, and that includes things like food, but also camping gear, like our camping stove and tent, but also things we want to create with. So Evan has a nice camera that we're going to be bringing with, and a computer to do editing and emailing and all that when we have internet, and also like a sound recorder. So yeah, we're taking all that with us. And we've been thinking about what the scope of the day is going to look like, and how we've kind of averaged it out is that if we do an average of 20 miles a day, that equals about like four and a half hours of running for us, at least the pace that we're going to be doing. So we're going to break that up if we want to, but if we also want to meet with someone or like get to a place, maybe do a larger chunk of that running, kind of get it all the way, and then we have a longer stretch of the day to do those other things. And, you know, it's also our first time doing it, so it might be like we might have to adjust what we can put our energy into if, like, well, this running is actually sucking way more out of us than we thought. Like, maybe we can't meet with this person, or maybe we have to take an extra rest day here. So I think it'll be very much an adjustment as we go along as well.
Well, and can you explain to people what ultra running is? Because, I mean, I know that running has become more popular as we've seen, you know, local runners like Scott Jurek, who have done these 100-mile runs. But explain it to people what that means when you're ultra running.
Yeah, for me, it's, I think this process for us has also been a way of figuring that out, because I think ultra running has become been trending lately, too. And with that kind of, its definition is a little more nebulous. Like, and from my understanding, that it just means like running a really far distance, like further than like marathons. And from what I've seen things that have been described as like a 50-kilometer race, so around like 30 miles as an ultra run. But there's also 50-mile races and like 100-mile races, often through like really crazy terrain. So I define it as like a really, really long, extended run. And we were, when we were talking about it, we were unsure, like, well, is this an ultra run? You know, like, we're going to be running 20 miles a day, but we're going to kind of break it up, you know, for lunch or for snacks. So we're not necessarily running 20 miles at a stretch every day. But we just kind of took it as, like, running a very far distance.
Okay. So you're not going to be, like, doing 30 miles in one stretch of time.
We could. That's a possibility. But we're as, because it's balancing between how far we want to go every day, but also just this kind of a long expedition. It's be 85 days in total, and depending on where we want to go and when we want to go. But we're assuming now, you know, not having done this before, that we'll do kind of maybe like 5-mile stretches 4 times a day to get 20 miles, or do 2 10-mile runs with like a half hour in between or something like that.
So I'm trying to do the math on this. If you're going to be out there for 85 days and running an average of 20 miles a day, is that 1,700 miles? Is that how far your trip is covering?
No, it's 1,300, but during that time, we're not running every single day. We have roughly 2 rest days a week. So those are days that we won't be running. But what we've, out of our research, is 1,300 miles on the road.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is such, I mean, some people think it's, they'll never ever accomplish a marathon in their lifetime, and here you are going 1,300 miles for an 85-day stretch. I mean, how do you plan to keep your energy up?
Yeah, that's been a question that we, I think, have been thinking about since the start, and also will be constantly revising and thinking about as we go along. But, so that means our food planning has kind of been, one, the biggest financial, logistical thing to deal with, but also nutrition and how to make sure we nourish our bodies so they don't quit on us as we run. That means we'll be eating a lot of, hopefully, very healthy food as we go around, and just making sure to maintain our bodies and take rest days. And I think one of the hardest parts is going to be just being honest with ourselves and each other. If we're like, yo, I can't do this today, you know, maybe can we like slow down, or revising the itinerary or something. I see that as a challenge more, because, you know, you can study like calorie input and output and the fat and calories you need, but you get very much emotionally tied up into it too. And I think that can be a risk as well, of being like, no, I need to do like finish this, and then maybe you end up hurting yourself when you could have just rested a day or something and gotten better.
Right. And, you know, everybody knows that the weather is pretty unpredictable, too, around the lake.
Yeah.
So you're planning to run, you know, no matter what, like rain or shine? Or?
Yeah, it's we got a rain jacket and rain pants and some tarps. So, yeah, whatever the weather, we'll be running. And we'll have, you know, all of our camping equipment, too, that should be set up for all sorts of scenarios. So even if it's raining or storming super hard and we can't run because maybe the visibility on the road is too low and that would be too dangerous, we could set up camp and, you know, be warm and dry at camp as well.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you too about the research that you're doing, you know, with Adventures in Scientists for Conservation.
Yeah.
So why did you pick microplastics or microbeads?
Yeah. They have a handful of research initiatives all around the world. They're doing things like roadkill and like a prairie survey. But the one that was kind of most pertinent to us was their global freshwater microplastics sampling, because we'll be close to Lake Superior most every day. And it's not an area that has a bunch of data contributed to it yet. And so we kind of saw that as a niche and that we could fill as we did our expedition.
Okay, so you're going to be taking water samples as you're running along the lake and submitting them to this group, or?
Yeah, so the way it works is it's a 1 liter water sample about once every week, and we want to sample from a variety of areas, so some places that are more remote and have less human impact, but also and other samples that are closer to maybe like river outputs to see kind of what the levels of pollution are in those very intense human activity areas. And so they're not time sensitive, which is actually a blessing for us, because we'll gather some, and then like when we're in Canada, we wouldn't want to ship internationally because we'll be sending them to Maine. So we'll be mailing them so we can hold on to those ones until we get back to the States. And then we mail them to their lab, which is in Maine. And then they do their analysis there and add it to their database.
So how many samples are you planning on collecting?
About in total 10.
Just from all areas around the lake?
Yeah, so they want it spread out as we can make it, and in a variety of kind of different levels of human presence.
And, you know, you said you're also going to be interviewing people and gathering stories that you're going to be posting mm-hmm. online.
Yeah.
So why did you decide you wanted to kind of collect that from people that are living around the lake?
I think there's, as we've been talking about this amongst ourselves, we've been trying to define it and kind of figure out, well, you know, there's, we want to run around the lake, but what is that all includes? But there's kind of this underlying assumption that this landform that people share matters, you know, this kind of idea of bioregionalism, like there's a place, a thing that many people share and that defines their life and their stories. And so what does that mean to actually live on a lake, you know? And we are especially interested in what Lake Superior has to offer as like as a environmental artifact, because it's just a ton of fresh water, and kind of looking into the future of a changing global climate, and also fresh water as a resource that's getting a lot more attention and need as human population grows. Like, well, what does that mean to everyone that is like a couple hundred feet away from a huge reservoir of fresh water?
Okay. And so are you going to be posting these stories or blogging or updating about your trip every day?
As much as we can. And it's really dependent, I think, on one, who we come in contact with, if we have people to talk to and that are willing to share their stories with us, but also if we have like internet. I know like a part, like the northeastern chunk of Canada, where it's going to be, it's a little more
hard to access Wi-Fi or an internet connection.
So in that case, we'll probably, you know, like create, you know, do our own editing and writing and then wait till we can connect to the internet. But yeah, I think the goal is to share as much as possible through our various channels like Facebook and Instagram and our website.
So when are you said you're heading out on May 20th, is that right, a Friday?
Yeah, May 20th from Ashland, Wisconsin.
And you just picked Ashland because that's where you guys, you know, all went to school together? And
yeah, I guess it was kind of our most shared location or the common denominator between all of us, so we chose there. And we have a lot of, I think it'll be a really good place to start and end, because we have a lot of friends there, a lot of people we know, and people that we want to talk to before we head out. And then also, I think it'll be a good place to be welcomed back into.
I guess if you could look ahead and see yourself 85 or 100 days from now, what would you hope to see at the end of this trip? What would you have hoped to have accomplished?
For me, it's, well, one, the microplastics pollution. If we can get all of those samples and send those out, and if they're successful, you know, there's a chance you could mess them up. But also with that, kind of talk to people about their awareness about microplastics pollution in the Great Lakes, because I think there's a really big awareness of plastic in the oceans, you know, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and things like that. But there's a huge problem of it in the Great Lakes, too, but it's not an issue that's necessarily, I think, is publicly talked about. So if we could fulfill our, like, research goals and also kind of bring awareness about microplastics, that would be a big plus. But another part of it is, like, the storytelling part, and that's more nebulous. You know, it's not necessarily much of a deliverable, like a thing that we're going to guaranteed have at the end. It's going to be very much dependent on the experiences we have. But if I can give, like, a face and a heart to this kind of landform and all the people that live around it, I think I will have accomplished my goal of giving, like, the emotional impact of what it means to be on the lake, especially in a changing climate and especially next to so much water.
Well, and you said originally you started out as a group of five friends talking about it, but there's three of you that are going to be going on the trip together?
Yeah, there's three of us now.
Okay.
Me, Evan, and Alyssa.
So where are you going to be posting stuff? How can people follow you online?
Our blog, as well as our information on who we are as a team, and also who we're partnering with, who's helping us with donations, or who we're collaborating with. You can find that information at ourshoresrun.org.
So what do you think is going to be the favorite part for you on this trip? Is there anything that you're really looking forward to?
Oh, I don't know. I'm super glad I get to swim in Lake Superior, hopefully every day. That's kind of been my favorite thing ever. But as far as location, I'm really, really excited about Pictured Rocks area in the Upper Peninsula. One, because I think I've just briefly visited there in the winter, and I think it's a really beautiful natural area. But also, we've gotten a lot of support. There's a lot of folks in Michigan that are interested in meeting up with us and talking with us and putting us up, you know, letting us stay at their cabins or taking us in for the night. So I think there's a lot of human interest there, too, and I think that's going to be a really exciting time to be doing the run.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me about this, Annie, and good luck. I really hope you get the best weather and have a great time meeting people and talking to people along the lake.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Andy Butter, a Northland College grad, talking about the trio's ultra run around Lake Superior. He and his friends are setting out this Friday from Ashland. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. When we come back, we'll hear from a researcher working with Adventures and Scientists for Conservation. Abigail Barrows joins us to talk about the nonprofit's work to study plastic pollution around the globe. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out. Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we've been talking about plastic pollution in the Great Lakes and beyond. We just heard from Northland College grad Andy Butter about his friend's ultra run around Lake Superior to aid microplastics research. Now we talk with one of the principal investigators working with the group that Butter and his friends are collecting water samples for. Abigail Barrows is working on the Global Microplastics Initiative with Adventures and Scientists for Conservation. Barrows spoke with us this morning about herself and her work.
My background is in marine science, and I've had an interest in the ocean and the environment since I was a small child. I grew up on a small island in Maine, and that's currently where I reside and have the lab for the microplastics research. I started working with Adventure Scientists in 2013. I had been working with a nonprofit in Maine doing microplastics research on the surface waters in the Gulf of Maine, and also working started a volunteer water quality monitoring group locally, and I quickly saw how impactful engaging local residents was in this sort of research. They were doing general water quality, looking at dissolved oxygen and nutrients and temperature and pH and salinity, and then I had them also start collecting surface water samples to look for microplastics. And rather than me running around to all these different sites, having the small team of people who were collecting samples weekly throughout the summer was really, tenfold expanded the amount of data I was able to collect. So an email came across my desktop from Adventure Scientist saying, hey, are you a scientist looking to expand your project globally? And I said, I filled out the little form and wrote a little blurb about microplastics and why this was a pressing issue. And I think that same day, the director, Greg Trinish, called me up, and the rest is sort of history. We expanded, the project expanded very quickly to be sampling marine waters around the world. We streamlined our protocols, and now everything is digital. So people collect data while they're out in the field using their smartphones. And the project has now had over 800 volunteers collect for this project. And we've had over almost 2,000 water samples collected internationally. Last year, we realized that fresh water was very under-researched in terms of microplastics distribution. And we started to expand into freshwater systems globally, and mostly have samples from here within the U.S., but also finding a lot of interesting plastics in freshwater systems.
Well, and explain to me, I mean, microplastics, they're these tiny plastic particles that don't break down that are often found in cosmetic products, right?
Correct. Yeah, so microplastics are classified as pieces of plastic that are less than 5 millimeters in size. They're broken down into two different categories. We have primary microplastics and secondary microplastics. So primary microplastics are what a lot of people have heard about. They're the microbeads that are put into personal care products that are used to exfoliate your skin, and they're also put into cosmetics. So those are the primary microplastics, microplastics that are made to be very small. Not only the microbeads that have now been federally banned, but also pre-production plastic pellets, so these things called nurdles that are shipped all over the world and melted down, and different chemicals are added to them. They're created, made into all of these different products that we use every day, so single-use plastics and things like that. And also another type of primary microplastic is what's used at boatyards and marine sandblasting. Sandblasting is a bit of a misnomer. They used to use sand, and now they commonly use little plastic pellets to take paint off and as an anti-fouling, removing fouling mechanisms on boats.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And secondary microplastics are larger pieces of plastic, such as bottles and bags, that break down over time through mechanical or chemical degradation. So your plastic bags, they might break down into smaller and smaller pieces, but they never really go away. And another huge contributor of secondary microplastics is our synthetic clothing. I think a lot of people aren't aware that every time you wash your yoga pants, your running shorts, your polar fleece, your synthetic anything, it sheds thousands of pieces of microfibers. And those microfibers make their way into our wastewater treatment systems and are not captured. For the majority of them make their way into our water systems. So those microfibers are being found everywhere. And in our research, we are finding 90% of our samples contain microplastics, and 90% of those microplastics are microfibers. So we think a lot of these microfibers that we are finding are coming from our heavy use of synthetic clothing.
That is also interesting, because I think people think about it more in terms of, you know, what they can see as far as these microbeads or, you know, the tiny little plastic particles that are contained in other things that you've mentioned. But, I mean, the clothing was not one that I had thought of.
No, it's very shocking to a lot of people, especially since polar fleece was championed as a very environmental product, because originally it was created through recycling old plastic. So it seemed like a really great way to extend and reuse these very persistent material that we've now created. Unfortunately, they do shed, one polar fleece jacket can shed almost up to 2,000 pieces per wash. And in the Netherlands, the Plastic Soup Foundation has been doing a lot of research on different types of clothing, and some clothing sheds up to 1 million fibers per wash. So if you think about that and the world population and how much we wash our clothing and how much of our clothing has some sort of synthetic blend in it, the impact is potentially enormous.
Well, and why are you looking and taking samples from all these volunteers worldwide? I mean, what does that tell you, or how is that information used?
Well, so Adventure Scientists is a nonprofit organization that addresses the world's most pressing environmental challenges, in which access to physical data is crucial to resolving them. So by leveraging the skills of this outdoor community, so kayakers, bikers, hikers, we're able to uniquely gather really difficult to obtain data at any scale and in any environment. So we're able to access some of those remote areas that me as an individual scientist would never have the time or the budget to do so. So by getting this worldwide snapshot of what's going on in terms of surface distribution and concentration of microplastics, we're hoping to use this data to leverage positive change and solutions through legislation, corporate responsibility, talking with industry in terms of organizations that outdoor businesses, outdoor clothing companies that create these synthetic clothing. So our job at this point is to really create a data set that can be used by all of these different stakeholders.
You know, by having volunteers worldwide, I get that the advantage of that is to access these remote areas, but then aren't you too concerned about the quality of the samples that are taken and the integrity of the results?
Absolutely. So that's something that has, coming to this from a scientific background, data integrity is of paramount importance for me as a scientist. I want data that I can really feel confident about and stand behind. As this project has developed, we have worked extremely hard to train the volunteers, make the protocols as user-friendly but also as data rigorous as possible. So we have checklists all along the way. We have a set protocol where every individual adventurer is triple rinsing the bottle. They take a picture of themselves in the bottle. They cap the bottle underwater so there's no potential for airborne contamination of the sample. That bottle is sealed and not reopened until it's in my very high quality assurance laboratory, where I work very hard to reduce any sort of potential contamination from the air or physical bodies in there. So, yes, citizen science and adventure scientists, adventure science, there's potential for contamination, but we have made that one of the biggest focuses of our project because it's so important with this type of research to have strength of data. So we have, we also do a lot of field blanks. I do laboratory blanks and controls to make sure that we are not contaminating the samples through using adventurers.
And so, you know, one of the other things you had mentioned is that you're seeing that freshwater areas are under research, and so you've now taken a look at that. And what are you seeing in the findings that you've obtained from, like, the Great Lakes, for example?
Off the top of my head, I can't pull out the Great Lakes data for you, but our combined marine and freshwater totals, we're seeing an average of 7 pieces of plastic per liter of water. As I had said before, 90% of the samples we have processed of our almost 2,000 samples have contained microplastics, and 90% of those microplastics are microfibers. We're seeing a little bit lower numbers of plastic contamination in our freshwater samples, but we also have not sampled as many freshwater sites as we have marine. But I think that freshwater, understanding microplastics in freshwater, rivers, lakes, streams, is really important for understanding how anthropogenic inputs are impacting marine plastic as well.
And by anthropogenic, also, you mean people?
Yes. So people living along watersheds impact the watershed. So better understanding what the concentrations are, what types of plastics we're seeing and finding in freshwater environments will help us better understand ways we can mitigate plastic pollution. And it's closer to the source. You know, the ocean is this very vast, large, hard-to-quantify environment. And by working in smaller freshwater systems, I mean, I think you could argue the Great Lakes is also very vast, but the point sources of pollution are much closer, and it can be easier to draw back to those pollution sources and see where we can make steps to reduce the amount of plastic inputs into those watersheds.
So, you know, as part of that, then you talked about using this data to leverage positive change. And I mean, are you hoping then, if you can pinpoint the source, that you can remove that plastic from the system?
Through the organization, we're not an advocacy group or a lobbying group, but our hope is that we can provide this data in such a package that municipals or grasswater organizations or legislators can access and interpret this data in a way that can help drive change. So using the Clean Water Act, maybe we can initiate some better filtration processes in our wastewater treatment plant, or look at some of the industry and textile mills and see what ways that we could also have better filtration that would be more effective in reducing the amount of plastics that some of these businesses might be contributing to.
And I imagine that, you know, one of the answers that you get on situations like that is that, well, it's so costly to make that type of change if we were going to see better filtration in treatment plants, but then to not do it, what's the cost of letting that plastic continue to go into lakes, rivers, and the oceans?
Absolutely, and that's always what it comes down to. The cost of making changes that are going to have less of a negative impact on the environment, the animals that dwell in that environment, and ultimately human health. So I think that the bigger question is what's the cost of our health as humans? And I think that reducing microplastic pollution will directly help improve animal and human health, because it's known and well documented that almost every animal that lives in an aquatic environment is impacted one way or another by plastics. And with the microplastics, what's really scary is that it is entering the food chain at the base level and only accumulating as you move up through the food chain. And as humans, we are at the top of the food chain in some of these instances. So it's really important to think how our health is being impacted by the pollution that we're releasing into these waterways.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about your research. Is there anything that you'd like to add?
I think I would like to add that this can feel like very dismal research, but what has been very heartening and given me a lot of hope is that people really do want to make change. They want to make the environment around them more healthy and have us have less of a negative impact on the environment. So I think that awareness is really the first step to creating this change, and that there's a lot of ways that you can reduce plastic in your own life, and there's a lot of resources out there to tap into to see where you can be more of the change that you want to see.
You've been listening to an interview with Abby Barrows, a researcher working on the Global Microplastics Initiative with Adventures and Scientists for Conservation. Construction season is already underway as many crews are working on summer road projects. Last year, the state began requiring local governments to use updated rainfall estimates from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for road projects. As Marcus White reports, changing weather patterns are affecting how roads are being built.
The Wisconsin DNR's Meg Galloway says they're asking communities to use a recent rainfall study by NOAA called Atlas 14 to help them design projects to withstand more rain.
Typically, when you are going to rehabilitate a bridge or a culvert, you have to know how large to make it so that you don't end up in a situation that water would go over the top of the road. Atlas 14 really helps the people who design infrastructure in and around water estimate a rainfall event, how much runoff is going to get to the river, and therefore what size bridge might be necessary.
Erin Abramson with Superior Public Works says the city has been redesigning some roads since a 500-year flood hit the Twin Ports in 2012.
We have hired engineering firms to do engineering studies to see what ways we can cost-effectively and effectively manage the water within these highly impacted areas.
Abramson says they're improving stream flow in Superior's Faxon Creek and adding storm sewers in other flood-prone areas.
I'm here on Poplar Avenue in Superior, where crews are adding storm sewers in a wetland basin, preparing for the upcoming reconstruction of Belknap Street. Abramson says this and other projects allows them to treat more stormwater before it runs into the bay.
Abramson says Superior would also like to increase capacity at the city's wastewater treatment plant to handle more runoff. In Ashland County, Highway Commissioner Emmer Shields says they're widening roads and culverts to account for the weather.
We calculate rainfall events on the basis of a 25, 50, 100-year cycle. In other words, what kind of, you know, what kind of an event can we expect in those time periods? And what we're finding out is we're having more 100-year storms than you would expect.
In the last 30 years, Shields says he's seen a half a dozen 100-year storms. He's concerned about what that might mean for a county with limited resources to maintain roads.
Nobody has enough funding, not even the state of Wisconsin. I mean, we're actually in a very dire situation right now with our budget. We're not in good shape.
Shields says their budget for road repairs is about $500,000, which pays for about 1 mile of road work each year. Most of that money comes from the state. In cities like Superior, Abramson says projects are funded through a stormwater and wastewater utility.
We make sure to try to do our best to make sure that all these projects are fully funded, that we won't have to apply assessments to homeowners to get this stuff done. A lot of these projects that we're doing right now are very large, grand sweeping projects in the realm of, you know, somewhere from $750,000 up to $2 million. You know, doing these really big projects is not cheap.
But Abramson says they make a huge difference in the long run because the upgrades help infrastructure weather the storm and cut down on costs to recover once it's passed. Marcus White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out. We hope to have you back with us next Monday. Until then, have a great rest of your week.